this morning. So Dustin got back into town late last night from his trip to Honduras, but we're glad that you're able to be back with us. I hope the trip went well. I'm sure it did, and we'll probably get to hear a little bit more about that later on. I must say I'm a little disappointed in you Tennessee fans. I fully expected a checkerboard or some stripes or something. I see a lot of orange, but I thought I might see a little bit more this morning. But in case you didn't hear, there was somewhat of a large football game for a lot of folks yesterday. But yeah, glad that everybody was able to make it back in here this morning after all of that excitement yesterday. Don't forget Upward. Our evaluations start this week, so I would really appreciate your prayers as we sign kids up to play. Hope you'll take some time to pray about that and make sure that we get kids in here and families in here that need to hear about God. I appreciate Tommy's songs this morning, all centered on our God. And that's what we're going to talk about for a little bit this morning is our sovereign God. But first off, I was thinking about probably the best Christmas present that I ever got. You know, Christmas is coming up before too long. One of the best Christmas presents I ever got, I was probably 12 or 13 years old, and I got a 10-speed bicycle. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever, because my family didn't have a whole lot, so getting that was a big deal. And I had the old ratty, just regular bicycle, and I rode bicycle all the time. I'd go to town in the summertime. I was gone all day just on my bicycle. Well, that morning I got up and there's this like silver, sharp 10-speed, you know, with the curved down handlebars so you're real aerodynamic as you're going and everything. And it had a speedometer. Just a little added bonus that my dad threw in there was a speedometer. So, you know, I could ride that thing, go down this big hill that our house was on, and I don't know if the speedometer worked real well or not, but I'd go like 90, 100 miles an hour down this hill, and it was awesome. But, you know, over time, that bicycle kind of lost its luster and its appeal, and I rode it a lot, but as I got closer to driving age, you know, the bicycle didn't have quite the same appeal that it did. But I did turn 16, and on my birthday, I went and got my driver's license. And then I scraped together $1,500, got myself a 76 Ford Pinto. And it was sharp. It was a sweet little ride. Well, you should have seen it, Tommy. I had a friend that was, his dad was a painter and a car painter, so he painted it for me. So it was like this kind of goldish color, and it had a dark brown stripe that went down the side. And it went up over the top like Starsky and Hutch's car, you know? So I drove the wheels off of that thing. I mean, back in that day, you know, I could get a half a tank of gas for about $3 or $4, and I just drove and drove all the time. I love that car. But again, it kind of lost some of its appeal over time. I actually had that car when Peggy and I got married, and we got a different car, and it kind of sat for a while, and I didn't care as much for it anymore. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't running that great. I sold it to a lady for like $300, and it was one of those deals where I wanted to meet her at the shopping center parking lot so she didn't know where I lived. So when she drove it off, you know, the sale was final kind of thing. So that car kind of lost its appeal as well. And that's what I want to talk about for a minute this morning. You know, unfortunately, important things can lose their appeal as well. You know, bicycles and cars in the big scheme of things are not that important. But relationships, you know, marriages, things like that over time can lose their luster and lose their appeal. And unfortunately, our faith can as well. And I think our reverence to God and our awe of God. You know, I grew up in the church and my whole life, went to Bible class. I heard all the awesome stories about God and all that kind of stuff. So my whole life, I've heard those stories. And, you know, it can become just kind of routine to us sometimes if we're not careful. I've said this before, but I've often been kind of jealous of people that come to Christ late in life, and they have that excitement and that zeal, and it's like a brand new thing. And, you know, I've kind of felt like maybe I missed out a little bit there, but I know I haven't. So what we want to take a few minutes this morning and just think about for all of us and remember how awesome our God is, and that he deserves all of our praise and all of our worship. And we're just going to talk about a few things, throw a few examples out there. There's some awesome examples in the Bible of God's awesome power and how immense he is. And sovereign just simply means that. He's the only one, the ultimate, the supreme power. There's no one else above him. Everything else falls below God. You know, one of the verses that came to mind was this first, in the first chapter of Colossians, where Paul was introducing and talking about this book and talking about God, and he said, "For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together." That's going to be kind of our overlying thought this morning. Everything is held together by God. Well, what got me started on this train of thought was listening to the book of Acts on my audio Bible, and kind of we're in the section of Acts here where Paul's been traveling around some, and he's been in Berea, he's been in Thessalonica, and he would go to the synagogue, and he would sit down and reason with people and talk with people. Well, the Thessalonican Jews started stirring up some problems and was getting pretty rough, and they were going to come after Paul, so the believers kind of got Paul away from there, and he wound up in Athens. So Paul's in Athens, and he goes there just to wait on Timothy and Silas to join him a little bit. So this first part, we're just going to talk about while Paul was in Athens. So he was there waiting for them at Athens. His spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. So it bothered Paul that as he was in Athens, there were all these idols and lots of different, you know, things that were worshipped and different ideas about gods and all this kind of thing. And because Paul knew there was only one true living God. So seeing all of this kind of bothered him. So he would reason with them, and he would go to the synagogues and he would talk to him. The verse before this, verse 21, talks about how the Athenians, they just like to do that. They like to debate. They like to sit around and talk about new ideas. So Paul jumped right in there with these folks, and he was going to talk to them. So in verse 22, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious." So one thing I wanted to point out, this is kind of a little sidebar, but was the approach that Paul takes here. You know, as he walked around and he saw all of these idols and stuff, he could have been very critical. He could have said, y'all are crazy. Why do you need so many idols? He could have been, you know, he could have approached it from that way, but he didn't approach it that way, because what would have happened had he approached it that way? They would have turned him off, right? They wouldn't have wanted to listen to that. So it's an interesting approach by Paul. And we need to remember our approach is important as we deal with people. And just a couple of quick examples was Jesus with the woman at the well in John chapter 4. If you remember, this was a Samaritan woman. Jesus was a Jewish man. So there were already a lot of barriers there that would have kept them from even talking to each other, right? The racial, there's gender problems there. But Jesus still took the time to sit down and talk to her. He wasn't critical. He talked to her about the living water. So he didn't let, you know, and we could throw in things like political differences, gender differences, all that. He didn't let any of that get in the way of sharing with this woman what the living water was. And then he also dealt with the woman in John chapter 8, the woman that was caught in adultery. Same kind of deal. This woman was caught in adultery, and they were going to stone her. But the way Jesus dealt with her, again, he didn't jump up and grab a rock to stone her as well, right? Remember, he talked to the crowd and said, whichever one of y'all has no sin, y'all go ahead and stone her. Well, they all had to disperse and leave because nobody could do that. So the way he dealt with this woman, even though she was guilty, he didn't condemn her. And later on it says, I don't condemn you either. So a good verse to remember, I think, is Colossians 4, where it talks to us about letting our speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. So the approach is really important. And as we're looking at Paul here talking to these Athenians, he took an approach that kept their attention. So he carries on. So Paul keeps talking. He says, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. So amongst all of these idols and altars and things, there was one that said, to an unknown God. And so Paul jumped on this opportunity to talk to them about the one true God. So it's another interesting approach by Paul. He wasn't critical. He wasn't condemning. He took that opportunity. He found a good place to start with them so that he didn't turn them off. And they were eager to listen, right? Because he said, I can tell you about this unknown God if you want to hear about it. So Paul took that opportunity to tell them about it. And this is how he starts. He starts with the sovereignty of God. He says, for the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. So I think it's really neat here that he finds a starting place with them, and he starts off telling them about the supreme being, because they had all these other gods and things, but he's telling them about the one true living God. And to break it down, he said, this God created the world and everything in it. This God is the Lord of heaven and earth. This God doesn't live in temples made by man. This God doesn't rely on man for anything. And this God gives everyone and everything breath and life. So he starts off with the sovereignty of God. So I thought for a minute we might take a minute to go back and kind of look at some of the great things that God did that are recorded in the Old Testament. These are all things that you've heard. But again, we don't want these things to lose their luster and lose that awe of God, because I want us to take a minute and step back and look at these things and think again, that's awesome what God did. So starts off with the creation. I mean, God spoke everything into existence. When God said, let there be light, there was light. When God said, you know, let there be vegetation on the ground and let there be birds and let there be, it happened the way he said it, he wanted it to happen. And then he created the stars and the universe, and just how immense that is and how amazing that is. And he created us and our bodies that are so amazing when you get down to the cellular level and how incredible and complex it is, and they are. God did all of that. He spoke it into existence. That's an awesome thing. And then later on, when man became so sinful, God destroyed the world with a flood. And through his mercy, he saved Noah and his family, but he was behind the flood and Noah building the ark and Noah gathering all the animals, and exactly how all that thing played out, God was behind that, and God was in every single detail. The plagues, okay? Now, we're kind of, don't look at that yet. We're kind of in the middle where the plagues are starting. And you remember the children of Israel were in Egypt, and Moses was going. God had sent Moses to help get them out of there. So some of the plagues had come, And it was kind of in the middle of all this, and then this verse in Exodus chapter 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Rise up early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus saith the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For this time I will send all of my plagues on you yourself and on your servants and your people, so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. For by now I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But for this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power, so that my name may be proclaimed in all of the earth.'" That verse tells me God's in control of everything, even when it doesn't look like he's in control of it. He's in control of it. You may have situations going on in your life right now where you think God's not involved in this, or, you know, it doesn't seem like God's near to me. God is in control of whatever situation. We may not understand that. We may not have the wisdom or the foresight to see how things are going to work out, but God is always in control. Stuff there going on with the plagues and with Pharaoh and everything probably seemed really crazy and out of hand and like, what's going on here? But that verse right there says, God says, "I raised you up for this very purpose." Okay? So God's in control of everything. One of the cooler stories in the Bible, I know some of y'all are familiar with this, is Ahab and the prophets of Baal and Elijah. So in 1 Kings chapter 18, God wanted Elijah to go find Ahab because they had been in a drought, and he was going to tell him that rain was coming, basically. So Ahab, of course you remember Ahab was a wicked king. He did wicked things in the sight of the Lord. His wife was Jezebel, who was also one of the more wicked people that ever lived. They led the children of God, or the children of Israel, to worshiping Baal and just all kinds of wicked things, right? So Elijah, basically, you know, God's prophet Elijah, he kind of got to a point where he said, it's time to kind of put up or shut up kind of thing. We're going to see who the real God is. He told the children of Israel, you need to decide. You need to make your mind up who your God is going to be. So if you remember the story, Elijah told Ahab, he said, gather everybody up at Mount Carmel. So all the children of Israel, you know, everybody gather up there. And he told Ahab, bring all of your prophets of Baal. There were 450 of them, apparently. And there were 400 other prophets of Asherah. So 850 prophets of Baal and these other gods and Elijah. And they're going to kind of have a duel here and see whose God is the real God. And if you remember, so Elijah told them, you take a bull, you put it on the altar there, and you start asking Baal for help, and we're going to see whose God will send fire to consume these sacrifices. So the prophets of Baal, they cut their bull up, they put it on the fire, and they start dancing around and doing their rituals and calling on Baal. And they did it all morning until about lunchtime, and nothing had happened. And so Elijah starts poking at him a little bit, and he says, well, maybe Baal's asleep, or maybe he's traveling somewhere, or, you know, maybe he's not interested. Y'all probably need to be a little bit louder. So the prophets of Baal start yelling louder, and it says they were cutting themselves and screaming to Baal and all that. Well, this went on most of the day till later in the evening, and nothing had happened. So Elijah got his bull, cut it up. He rebuilt an altar there, put the bull on it. He dug a trench around it and then had buckets of water poured on it to soak it down real good, so much that water filled the trench around it. And then this happens in about verse 37. So Elijah goes to God and he says, answer me, O Lord, answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned your hearts and that you have turned their hearts back. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood, and the stones, and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. I kind of like to think of that as just a duel, right? The Baal guys and the God guys. and the God guys came out on top there, like they're always going to, right? And then last story is Nebuchadnezzar, and this is a really neat story too in Daniel chapter 4. And we'll go through it real quickly, but remember Nebuchadnezzar was the king over Babylon, and Daniel, and he was the king when Daniel got thrown in the lion's den and all that stuff happened. Well, the next chapter after, Nebuchadnezzar is talking and he tells about this dream that he had. And in this dream, he sees a huge tree, so big that it reaches to the sky. And you can see it from the ends of the earth. And every living thing can take shelter in it. It's got food for everything. It's just this majestic tree. Well, he has that dream. Nebuchadnezzar has that in his dream. So he calls Daniel to interpret it. And ultimately, what Daniel says is, that tree is you, right? And part of the dream was, too, that a messenger came down from heaven and cut the tree down. And so Daniel tells him that that tree represents you, right? And that's what's going to happen to you. So later on, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, about a year later, he's out walking around on his palace, and he's looking at just how awesome he is. He's just looking at this, the dynasty there, the kingdom there, and just thinking, man, I have built something incredible. And at that point is when God pulled him away. And if you remember, Nebuchadnezzar was taken away from the people. He was told he had to live with the animals. He had to eat grass. The dew was going to fall on him. Nebuchadnezzar's hair grew long. Says it was like feathers all over him. His nails grew long. So he basically became like a wild animal and had the mind of a wild animal for 7 years. And the idea was that he was going to do that until he acknowledged that God was the supreme God. And so this happened in Daniel chapter 4. So at the end of the days, after those 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar lifted my eyes to heaven and my reason returned to me. When he lifted his eyes to heaven, he's acknowledging that God is the one and only God. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar says. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. Just an incredible thing that Nebuchadnezzar turned around and admitted that God was the one and only Most High God, when at one time Nebuchadnezzar thought he was the most majestic thing in the world. So I wanted to take a quick look as we close up. So this God is sovereign. He's majestic. He's all-powerful. He's all-knowing. You know, all of those things that we talk about God, he is also worthy of our worship. One of the neat verses, I think, in Revelation is in chapter 4 when you see that scene, that worship scene. So I wanted to read that to you. And I just want you to kind of think about this while I read it. See if you can picture this scene in your mind. This is what was going on in heaven when John was given an opportunity to look into heaven. Okay? In John chapter 4, John says, "After this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. And the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, 'Come up here, and I will show you what must take place.' At once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper. A rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seating on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder. Before the throne, 7 lamps were blazing. These are the 7 spirits of God. Also before the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. In the center around the throne were 4 living creatures, and they were covered with eyes, front and back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second was like an ox, the third like a man, and the fourth was like an eagle. Each of the 4 living creatures had 6 wings and was covered with eyes all around, even under its wings. Day and night, they never stop saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory, honor, and thanks to him who sits on the throne and who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who sits on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever. They lay their crowns before the throne and say, "You are worthy, O Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being." Now, I don't understand everything that's going on there with the creatures and all that, but I do know one thing. God is being worshiped 24/7 in heaven. Whatever's going on in heaven, it revolves around God, and it revolves around him being worshiped. I think we need to just kind of think about that in our lives and think about how often we think about God and how often we worship our God, because he's worthy. He's awesome. He's sovereign. He's everything we've talked about this morning. He deserves our worship, and we need to give him that worship. So to wrap up our story with Paul, it says, and so Paul's finishing up his talk to the Athenians, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. So this incredible God, the thing that he wants is a relationship with us. As crazy as that sounds, as supreme as he is, as awesome as he is, the thing that he wants is to have a relationship with us and to draw us near to him. And this last verse we're going to look at as we close in Romans chapter 5, that relationship comes through Jesus. That relationship with God, everything was done through Jesus Christ. In Romans 5:8, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." So that's the gospel right there in one verse. God wants to have a relationship with us. He is the supreme being in this universe, in all universes. He wants to have a relationship with us, and we can have that through Jesus. Jesus came, he died for us, he was raised, and now he sits up there on the throne with God and is knocking on that door of our heart, you know, all the time, so that we will join him and have a relationship with him. So the thing I want you to take away this morning is just hopefully a rekindled awe of our great God and a desire to worship him in everything that we do, every part of our life, that we will worship him because of how great and how good and how awesome he is. This morning, if you don't know God, if you don't know Jesus and what he did for us, we would love to share that with you. Or if you just would like to have the prayers of this church this morning, this is a good opportunity to do that. So if you would like to do that, you can come while we stand and sing this final song together.